Welcome to Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Caglione. How are you doing, Frank?
David, I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. We are just about to hit festival season here, and they are constructing a beer garden, I think, in our car park. So if you hear loud banging noises in the background while you're listening to this podcast, that's our beer garden under construction. Our apologies, but we'll hit the beer garden after the show.
Everyone should have a beer garden outside their office.
Exactly. Some notes work we get done in August. All right. In recent weeks, some of the big headlines have been about the arrest of Maria Butina, a Russian grad student, supposedly, for violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And also in the news, investigations into former Trump associate and foreign policy advisor Carter Page for also being a potential Russian agent.
David, have you seen Carter Page interviewed?
I have not.
You have to. Listeners, if you haven't, David, you must go on YouTube and find some of the interviews with Carter Page. I think he was on CNN last Sunday on Jake Tapper's program, State of the Union, if memory serves. He is bonkers. And frankly, and I say this with minimal respect, really, if I'm totally honest. He's a bit of a dope, too. He isn't the sharpest knife in the drawer. But he's... Anyway, sorry. I have Carter Page on my mind.
That's don't you? The president only hires the best people.
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does. Yes.
You seek out interviews with Carter Page. Right. You won't regret it. If you're looking for kill some time at lunch, go on YouTube and find Carter Page.
All right, so for those of you who aren't keeping up with both of these stories, the sort of cliff note version of the Maria Butina story is she came to the United States supposedly as a grad student, but quickly became deeply involved in entwined in Republican circles and NRA circles, claiming that she was the head of a Russian gun rights organization and had her picture taken with all kinds of Republican and NRA operatives over the past couple of years.
She's also involved in the periphery of the kind of evangelical Christian movement. So
sure.
She's kind of the nexus of where the Russian relationship with Trump, gun rights, and evangelical Christianity come together in a bizarre way.
Sure, and the claims against her made by the Justice Department is that her pretenses of being both a graduate student and a head of a Russian gun rights organization really was a pretense for her being an agent of the Russian government. So we thought this would be an interesting time to talk about foreign agents, in particular about this sort of Foreign Agents Registration Act that's been in the news a lot recently. Before we get to that, I think we need to define what a foreign agent is, because a foreign agent, I think, is something different than a spy and something different than a diplomat. What exactly do you think a foreign agent is?
Yeah, I mean, I think in this context, David, you're right, because both, although Maria Butina seems to have entered the United States under false pretenses, as it were, claiming to be a graduate student, she was fairly upfront about what she was doing.
Yeah.
You know, so she was representing this Russian gun rights organization, which was likely funded by the Russian government. And Carter, the accusation against Carter Page, again, isn't that he was engaged in espionage. And again, if you watch an interview with Carter Page, you will know he's not capable of espionage unless he's so skilled and this is all an act. But we'll leave that for another episode. So I think I think when we hear the words foreign agent together, one thinks of spies. You think of James Bond. Mm. That's not what we're talking about. And I don't think that's what we're talking about with these two individuals, which are kind of prompting our discussion today. I think we're talking more about foreign representatives acting in the United States or in American history. And I think the two examples we have before us are good ones, because in the case of Maria Butina, we have a foreign national who's come to the United States more or less to represent the interests and promote the interests of her country in particular sectors of American life. With Carter Page, we seemingly have, and we should say it's an allegation at this point, which he does deny, but the allegation is that he, an American citizen, was acting on behalf of a foreign state within the United States. So I think there's a slight distinction you made there. But what, in answer to your original query, David, what we're not necessarily, what we're not talking about is people engaging in espionage per se. That's a separate topic. There's a kind of close relationship between the two, obviously. And in fact, I suspect that in some cases, and maybe in these cases, people acting as foreign agents are also acting as spies, or being a foreign agent might be a cover for being a spy. But that's not what we're talking about.
That being said, I think there are lots of foreign agents who are doing entirely legitimate things that aren't even connected with sort of espionage. So you could imagine, you know, right now there are thousands of foreign agents registered in the United States who represent business interests abroad, who are coming to the United States to lobby various politicians and other groups for their business interests. And
I've met in my travels and work for the university, I've encountered on a fairly regular basis people who represent Scottish industry in the United States. Those are the kinds of foreign agents we're talking about in this context. Yeah, sure.
Those are people who are registering with the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and they say, look, here I am working for the Scottish haggis industry. I'm here to overturn the ban on haggis imports, and, you know.
Right, exactly. So there are foreign agents like that. They are not diplomats, because diplomats obviously are accredited and formally represent governments, and they're in charge of government-to-government relations. And they're not engaging in espionage, so they're kind of in a liminal space, kind of third space.
And so being a foreign agent doesn't in and of itself mean you're engaged in underhanded activity. Although the ones we're going to talk about tend to be the ones who are.
Well, the fun ones.
The ones who are lobbying for, you know, the haggis industry are probably not all that. Well, I'm sure they're great guys, but anyway. You know, thinking about the sort of early history of this, you know, is there a colonial era sort of equivalent of foreign agents that we could think about in order to provide some context? I think mostly we're going to be talking about the 20th century.
Sure. I mean, I think the most immediate example that comes to mind is Benjamin Franklin.
Hmm.
And Benjamin Franklin served in the 1760s as what was called a colonial agent in London. And so what he did was he represented a number of colonies, most notably his home colony in Pennsylvania, but also Massachusetts and a few others. He represented their interests in London. Now, you and I, before we went on the air, had a brief discussion about this, and we talked about whether that constitutes whether it's appropriate to describe that as being a foreign agent, because of course these colonies were part of the British Empire. I would see it more as being a lobbyist. So to some extent, he represented the interests of these colonies, which of course weren't represented in Parliament.
Sure.
In London, and he frequently testified before Parliament. He was called before parliamentary committees, sometimes effectively as immediately after the Stamp Act, and also sometimes in contentious circumstances in the run-up to the American Revolution. So I think that's a good example. Yeah. It doesn't quite fit because, of course, whether he's actually foreign or not is debatable.
Sure.
But I think the kind of role of colonial agents in the 18th century is a pretty good indicator.
But most foreign agents today are essentially lobbyists, right?
And so, I guess so, yeah. They just happen to be foreign.
Yeah.
So,
and in as much as the American colonies didn't have representation in Parliament, et cetera, et cetera, that he is in some ways serving a similar kind of function. He's representing a non-represented body within Parliament, if you ignore the sort of virtual representation argument.
Right,
you know.
But what is interesting in terms of thinking about Franklin, I think, David, is what happens to him after the American War of Independence breaks out. So in the he's sent back to Europe after the War of Independence breaks out, more or less to represent the interests of the American revolutionaries on the continent and try to win support for them, particularly diplomatic support. Mm-hmm. So he's acting as an unofficial diplomat, especially in France, in the run up to the formal treaty between France and the United States in 1778. And at that point, of course, because he's not a formally accredited diplomat, he's more like a foreign agent. So he's acting as a foreign agent, I think, in that brief period, and quite important period. He's very effective at it in the kind of mid-1770s or during the War of Independence. After the treaty between France and the United States is concluded, he will be a formal diplomat.
Sure.
And that's a slightly different, as we've said already, that's a kind of different category of behavior. But he was certainly a foreign agent then. So there are some antecedents here back in the kind of, in my period, the 18th century, I think, that are germane.
Now, when you, there's one example that comes to mind immediately after the revolution, and that's the Citizen Genet affair. How does that sort of fit into this paradigm?
Oh, Citizen Genet is a great character. In fact, there should be a movie made about him. Maybe there was. I don't know. Or a musical.
Exactly. It's the sequel to Hamilton. He doesn't appear in Hamilton, does he?
He does not appear in Hamilton. Okay. And so Citizen Genet, Edmond Charles Genet, is a French diplomat who's sent to the United States in 1793. He's a very interesting character. His dad was a translator at the court of Versailles, and according to legend, young Edmund could speak multiple languages at a very young age. He served as French ambassador, to the court of Catherine the Great, and was expelled because of, basically Catherine the Great didn't like him, and he didn't like her, and they... he was expelled from St. Petersburg, and when the French Revolution broke out, he was quite an ardent revolutionary, and he was dispatched to the United States to represent France at the United States. So he doesn't quite fit our model because he was a diplomat, but I think he's a good example because when he got to America... he acted in a very undiplomatic fashion because he sought to promote French interests well beyond his brief as an ambassador. And so he gave out commissions to a bunch of ship captains to act as privateers. So American ship captains to act as French privateers in the wars of the French Revolution, particularly against Britain. And this was well beyond his brief as an ambassador. It violated the Neutrality Act, which the United States was committed to being neutral in the wars of the French Revolution, and this violated both the spirit and the letter of the Neutrality Act. And Genet got himself in hot water. He is repeatedly warned by the Washington administration, by the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, by President Washington to stop doing this. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't listen. He basically says, I'm going to go above your head.
He's going straight to the American tour.
He goes on a speaking tour. And he's fed it because the French Revolution in its early stages was popular in the United States. And so he arrived in Charleston in 1793 and he's greeted by cheering throngs. Mm-hmm. And this kind of goes to his head. And he basically tells Washington that I'm going to go over your head directly to the American people, believing that he's more popular than Washington was. Well, he wasn't. And eventually he's recalled, and he's to be sent home in disgrace. But there's been a change of government back in Paris, as there frequently was during the French Revolution. And I believe Genet was a Girondist, and the Jacobins had come to power. And he was going to be executed when he got back to France, or at least he had a reasonable fear that he was going to be executed. And the Washington administration, which he had done nothing but annoy to great end, offered him asylum. And so Genet actually lives until, I believe, 1834. He marries an American woman, becomes a farmer in upstate New York. he's spared what would have been his fate, which is he would have gone home and probably met his end at the guillotine. And the Washington administration allows him to stay, despite his efforts to drag the United States into a war with Britain and his completely undiplomatic behavior. So although he was an accredited diplomat, he kind of... he acted egregiously as a foreigner.
Well, I mean, so the role of a diplomat both in the 18th century and today is as representative of a government to another government.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing that Genet did that really sort of put him outside the bounds of that, I think the thing that actually makes him a foreign agent, is he said, look, I am a representative of the French people to the American people. Ignore what your government has to say. I will speak directly to the American people through public speeches, through newspapers, through other kinds of means to try to influence American politics.
That's right. And crucially, Genet is interfering in domestic politics in the United States. Are seeking to. He doesn't do it very effectively.
Well, and I think most of these foreign agents we're going to talk about don't do a particularly effective job at it. But I think that's one of the ways that sort of distinguishes them from diplomats is, you know, diplomats have a fairly well-defined set of rules. And the rules haven't changed dramatically in the past 250 years about, you know, the kinds of protocols of what a diplomat should and shouldn't do.
You don't interfere in the politics of your host country.
And you have certain specified... You know, you have certain specified people you talk to in the government, and, you know, you don't sort of give public declarations about much of anything.
Although, interestingly, and his name escapes me, maybe you can Google it while I'm speaking, the current U.S. ambassador in Germany...
Yes, who got a lot of in trouble for...
Has got in trouble because he's acted a bit Genet-like in the sense that he's sought to interfere with in German domestic politics and made pronouncements... to that effect.
He favored the right-wing party.
That's right.
Richard Grenell.
Right, and he's got himself in hot water. So he's acted a bit like Genet did, I think.
But, you know, Genet did it to a, you know, much higher level.
Yes, and then it all ended badly.
For him, yes.
Although, as I said, he settled down in the United States had quite a long afterlife after this moment of notoriety in 1793 and 94 when he kind of sought to undermine the United States government. And he tried to change his U.S. policy, really.
But I think in some ways that example, you know, sort of prefaces a lot of the sort of other examples we're going to talk about is, you know, these foreign agents are very much about either, you know, about U.S. involvement in foreign wars or getting foreign governments to be involved in the United States in some way. You know, thinking about, you know, my own time period, there aren't foreign agents acting in the United States, but there are American and Confederate foreign agents operating in the UK during the American Civil War because the Confederacy very much wanted British intervention on their behalf throughout the conflict, hoping very much to have the kind of, you know, support that, say, the French gave the colonists during the American Revolution.
So they're akin to what Franklin was doing.
To some degree. But, I mean, so there are some people who are Confederate agents who are official Confederate diplomats. And so there's Mason and Slidell and a whole bunch of guys who the Confederacy sends as official representatives of the Confederate government. But beyond that, there are also a host of Confederate agents who are trying to not directly lobby the British government, but to lobby the British people. So there are Confederate newspaper agents. There's a guy named Henry Holtz who goes into British newspapers and even has his own newspaper for a while in London. There are pro-Confederate newspapers and tries to get pro-Confederate editorials published in British newspapers to get the British people on the side of the Confederacy. There are also United States agents who are doing very similar things, although they're sometimes less effective, who are trying to lobby up public support for the Union in the UK. You know, likewise, there are Confederate agents who are engaged in economic transactions in Britain where they're not officially representatives of the Confederate government, but they're also not agents of the Confederate government. They're buying ships, they're buying supplies, and even though Britain is theoretically neutral, these people are acting on behalf of the Confederate interests. And in some places you have Confederate agents going around trying to persuade people of things and then Union agents are following and trailing them going around. And people are pretty clear about who these people are. And this isn't particularly clandestine activity, although there is some of that as well.
And I think that's an important distinction when we're talking about foreign agents as opposed to espionage.
No, that's right.
People are acting usually openly.
No, yeah, so people know who these Confederate agents are, you know, and sometimes they obfuscate in some ways, like Maria Butina. Sometimes they obfuscate exactly who they're representing, but they're not like the Americans in the TV show where they're, you know, hiding their identity and trying to present like they're something they're not. I mean, ultimately, all those Confederate efforts, the agent, both by the agents and by the Confederate diplomats, failed because Britain didn't intervene on the side of the Confederacy. Although I think they probably came a lot closer to intervening on the side of the Confederacy in large part because of the effectiveness of some of these Confederate foreign agents. I think they did a really good job, especially in 1861, 1862, laying out a case before the British people that they should side with the Confederacy against the Union.
So it seems to me, David, that in the examples we've seen thus far, that we can draw a distinction between the kinds of activities that foreign agents are engaged in, whether they be representatives of foreign states within the United States or Americans in other countries. There is propaganda activity, where you're trying to influence public opinion in the host nation. And there's more kind of lobbying efforts to change policy in the host nation.
Yes.
Is that fair?
I think that's most of what these foreign agents are doing, right? And I think that's, you know, both with the historical examples and the contemporary ones. But this story, I think, really takes off during World War I. I think, you know, we've got these isolated examples from the 18th century and the 19th century. When you get to the 20th century, I think you're really starting to see this idea of having foreign agents have a sizable presence in the United States and having a meaningful impact on policy, or at least trying to have a meaningful impact on policy, especially in the First and Second World Wars, where Germany, I think, is very much interested in both cases in preventing U.S. entry into those wars on behalf of Britain and France and the other allies. And using not only sort of diplomatic means to try to do that, but using foreign agents to help, you know, sow dissent within the United States to create, supporting those people, voices within the United States that are hostile to or critical of U.S. involvement.
Don't forget that, of course, between 1890 and 1920 or 1924 was an era of mass immigration to the United States. And so there were large diasporic communities within the United States that could trace their own origins back to the belligerent states during both those conflicts. And that was important. So, again, the propaganda effort might be aimed at those communities, but also in trying to mobilize those communities to influence government policy.
During World War I, for instance, Germany is trying to get the German-American community on side with not entering the war. But they're also targeting other groups, and they say, thinking that they could find sympathetic voices. So they go to Irish-Americans, and they say, look, you know, if we enter this war on the side of, if the United States enters the war on the side of Britain, Britain has been oppressing Ireland for centuries. Therefore, you should oppose U.S. entry into World War I. Likewise, they go to African Americans and they use a very similar kinds of argument. Do you want to, you know, to enter this war to support the United States when the United States doesn't pass anti-lynching legislation? German agents are funding newspapers. There's a case in 1915 where a German a worker in the German embassy, a guy named Heinrich Albert, accidentally leaves his briefcase, on a train in New York. And when the Secret Service opens it up, it looks like the German government is financing newspapers and financing favorable editorials in American newspapers, to this end, to try to get Irish Americans and other groups to support policy of neutrality or non-intervention in the First World War. And one of the interesting things that happens, I think, and some friends of the podcast, Roger Jeffries Jones and Doug Charles, have written about this, is, you know, the FBI, when it looks at all this, they say, well, there's not much we can do. In fact, these people haven't actually broken any laws. That, you know, spending money on newspapers to publish editorials isn't actually a criminal offense that we can do anything about particularly. But it's this, I think, really repeated efforts by Germans in the First World War that ultimately leads to the Foreign Agents Registration Act in 1938.
Right, as the country's gearing up for another war. But before we get to that, I want to back up a little bit. Franklin placed things in the French press. Mm-hmm. Your Confederates and Union representative agents were putting things in the British press in 1860, 61, and 62, and so on. We see the Germans doing it in the United States press during the First World War, as you've ably laid out. But as you observe, it's not necessarily illegal. I mean, writing things for the press is that's what happens in a free society. Mm. And I'm thinking, because one of the things that's been a preoccupation in the coverage of the Trump administration has been the Russian influence on social media, for example.
Sure.
The Russian bots and things like this.
And Facebook and Russia Today.
Yeah, Facebook and Twitter. And I mean, Russia Today is kind of more conventional in that it's pushing a certain line, but you know that when you tune in. I guess my question is, or my statement and my observation is, that what we're seeing is that the Russians, in seeking to pursue a certain line, are just using new media, but the activity itself isn't all that new.
No, I think it's in some ways very, very similar to sort of earlier efforts of foreign agents. In some ways, this is a fairly familiar story.
And that the United States has done in other countries, of course.
To be sure, right. I mean, the United States is engaged in all kinds of propaganda activity and used various fronts of different kinds to that end.
I know we need to go back to the Foreign Agents Registration Act and the Second World War, but it just occurred to me as you were speaking,
yeah,
that if we see that kind of Russian activity, now that's not the same thing as Russian intelligence agents colluding, as has been alleged, and as Robert Mueller's investigating, with the Trump campaign. That's different from than Russian agents, as we've discussed them, disseminating information and seeking the influence of the electorate.
Sure.
So I think all of this has kind of been put in the Russia basket, and I think it's been a little bit confusing and confused, perhaps, in the way the media has covered it. But I think there's a difference between the intervention in the election by agents of the Russian state, and Mueller's indictments last week or the week before last of 12 intelligence agents
in Russia
is different from RT.
Sure. Well, so I mean, it's one of the things I think that happens when foreign agents are functioning well, sometimes they can get other people to be foreign agents without knowing that they're foreign agents. And I think Carter Page might be the case example of this, because he seems to have become a Russian agent without knowing it.
He's Forrest Gump, for goodness sake. Anyway.
But the one of the first people that's prosecuted under the Foreign Agents Registration Act was actually an American pilot, a woman by the name of Laura Ingalls, who was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic, I believe. And she was a member of one of the spokespersons for America First during the Second World War, just before the Second World War, which was an organization, America First, if that sounds familiar, it's familiar for a reason. America First was this very short-lived organization, lived for about a year and a half, that opposed U.S. entry into the First World War.
Second World War.
The America First part confused me there. So it's founded in 1940, breaks up in 1941 after Pearl Harbor. But it's very briefly a very popular organization. It has hundreds of thousands of members around the United States. It had lots of influential people. Seems like pilots who flew across the Atlantic seem to be all the members. Charles Lindbergh was famously a spokesperson for it. But Laura Ingalls, this woman, was a spokesperson for America First and was giving speeches to the effect the United States should not interfere in the Second World War. And she basically ran out of money to go on her speaking tour. And the German government said, oh, you need money to go on your speaking tour. We can give you money to go on your speaking tour. And she ends up getting $250 a month to help fund her expenses as she goes around arguing for U.S. non-intervention. And she becomes one of the first people prosecuted as being a foreign agent and spends 20 months in prison for it. And she said, look, I'm not a foreign agent. I'm an American. I'm a patriotic American. I don't think the United States should get involved in this. And these people wanted to give me some money to help me do it. But in some way, she became inadvertently an agent of Nazi Germany and the consequences.
So is in her case, and I wasn't familiar with that case. The problem is that she got money from the German state. She could have said all the things she said as a U.S. citizen.
Right? Yes. And but I mean, one of the things about America First is that the historians have looked into it. It seems as if there are a significant number of German agents who are infiltrating that organization, getting even if they're not the ones running it, they're getting close to some of the people who are running it. There also were, at actually the very beginning, before the Nazis turned on the Soviet Union, there were also Soviet agents, apparently, in America First, arguing for American non-intervention in the Second World War until halfway through 1940, when all that changed. But you're finding lots of German agents in groups like America First, in the lead-up to U.S. entry in the First World War, engaging in lobbying efforts, sort of getting people to support particular causes. There was a German agent who got into the office of Congressman Hamilton Fish and was trying to sort of push Congressman Fish and other people in Congress to support non-intervention in the Second World War. And ultimately, at the end of the war, there are dozens of prosecutions based on the Foreign Agents Registration Act of mainly either people German agents themselves or people who are wittingly or unwittingly to various degrees working on behalf of Germany during the Second World War.
So we get a spate of this, David. In the first half of the 20th century, during both world wars.
Yes.
But it seems to me that during the Cold War, much of this gets formalized in the sense that the state, whether it be the United States or its adversary, the Soviet Union, are taking on this activity themselves, either the propaganda side of things. So we don't necessarily see the same. There's lots of espionage going on, of course, during the Cold War. I mean, there's a huge amount of espionage. But we don't see non-state actors acting in this way.
Well, I think part of it is these kinds of foreign agents, if they are effective at all, they're effective in a pre-war context, right? So the German foreign agents are mostly operating in both world wars. Not when the United States is involved, but immediately prior to U.S. involvement, trying to stop U.S. involvement. In the Cold War, even if the Cold War never actually ended up being a shooting war, at least on a large scale, one could not reasonably go in Cleveland and say, the United States should change its policy towards the Soviet Union because they really are friends. You couldn't say that in 1955, just because of the nature of American politics and the ways in which the discourse was working. So there are relatively limited cases, at least of prosecution for the Foreign Agents Registration Act during the second half of the 20th century.
So it flourishes, although this activity seems to have flourished now in the wake of the Cold War again.
Well, so there's a few cases that are during the Cold War that are interesting. There's a case in 1951 in which the United States goes after W.E.B. Du Bois, the famous historian and sociologist. He was the head of a group called the Peace Information Center, which was sort of an anti-war group on a sort of global scale. And Du Bois had connections with global socialism on a variety of levels. And the U.S. government came in and said, basically, this organization, the Peace Information Center, is a front for the Soviet Union, and you're engaged in illegal activity as a consequence of that. In this particular case, the case got thrown out almost immediately by the judge, who said, look, there's not evidence here of actual Soviet involvement in it. But one of the things you do see is fairly selective prosecution. So there are a couple times in the 1980s, for instance, in which groups that actually did register as being pro-Northern Israel, or Northern Ireland, sorry, Northern Ireland are getting prosecuted by saying, when they claim to be representatives of one group, when in fact the United States said they were fronts for the IRA. And that happens a couple times in the 1980s. But there's also cases in which there are pro-Israel groups that some people say should be prosecuted for being foreign agents who are not, where the pro-Israel group says, look, we're not foreign agents, we are simply Americans who are supporters of Israel, we're not acting on behalf of a foreign government, and therefore we don't have to register and disclose our finances and all those other kinds of things that go along with registration. So there have been some claims in the second half of the 20th century that the United States is, like all things, selectively enforcing this particular piece of legislation.
But interestingly, in those cases, the agents are acting on behalf of allied or friendly countries,
sure,
as opposed to countries that are seen as adversaries.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
There's a couple other cases. There's a few other cases of people who are prosecuted for being fronts for governments in Latin America and Cuba and other places, but it's really relatively rarely enforced. It seems to be, you know, the Second World War seems to have been the epicenter, and I guess now when we're having these cases come to the fore. How are we thinking about the Carter Page case and the Maria Butina case? How do we contextualize those then, now that we've sort of talked about the long history of foreign agents? How do these current cases fit?
I think that maybe they're on two tracks. So Maria Butina seems to be what she is, a citizen of a foreign state, the Russia, and she's come to the United States seemingly for propaganda purposes and to promote sort of pro-Russian policies, if you will, but as a propagandist. So she seems to have recognized the power of and importance of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, at least in Republican politics, and sought to gain influence there in order to kind of propagandize, I suppose. Whereas Carter Page is an American citizen who was acting in an American political campaign. Mm. I mean, he was a foreign policy advisor to then candidate Trump, who seems to have also been acting on behalf of Russia. Again, this is an allegation at this point, and the details are a little bit murky. He's done nothing to clear them up when you hear him speak. But that would seem to me to be a case of, if we take the facts as we know them and interpret and accept them, that he was acting to change policy. So if we do this distinction earlier in our discussion between propaganda, trying to influence what the public thinks, that's what Maria Butina seems to have been doing. Or policy, changing policy, shaping policy, that seems to have been what Carter Page has been doing. So I think that the fact that one is a foreign agent who went to the United States or a foreign citizen who went to the United States to act as an agent, Maria Butina seems to fit that description, whereas he's an American acting on behalf, again, allegedly, of a foreign state. So there are kind of two tracks here, and they seem to represent both of them.
Exactly. I mean, one has to wonder how, you know, just looking at these records, foreign agents on the whole aren't particularly effective. At least it doesn't seem that way when the Germans tried to stop the U.S. intervention in both their world wars. Clearly, that didn't work on their behalf, although one wonders, you know, the United States may have gotten involved earlier had those two things, had those German agents not been involved.
I mean, if we think, let's look at the examples we've given, okay? Franklin's a colonial agent for the American colony, British North American colonies in London. Hmm. Well, that didn't end well.
Depends on how you read that.
Well, yes, it's true. Oh, that could have sounded very unpatriotic. Genet is trying to bring the United States into the war between France and Britain on behalf of France. Well, that doesn't happen. Your Confederates don't succeed in bringing Britain into the American Civil War on behalf of the Confederacy. German agents do not succeed in bringing the United States into either First or the Second World War on behalf of Germany, or keeping the United States out. It might have delayed their entry. We can never know. And so maybe we're too worried about this. Well, you don't seem terribly worried about it, but it's...
Well, I'm worried in as much as you know, the presence of foreign agents seems to be, you know, the tip of an iceberg, or a small part of a much bigger agenda. Because after all, the German agents who were tried to stop U.S. intervention in the World Wars, the United States ended up going to war with Germany, both those cases, and millions of people died. And in as much as we have lots of Russian agents who are wandering around the United States, both the ones we know about and presumably ones we don't know about, does that preface war with Russia, which would have disastrous consequences? What is the ultimate effect of these foreign agents on American politics? I think it's very hard to sort of quantify their effect, but it's. I think it demonstrates that if we didn't know this already, that Russia is not a friend of the United States at the moment, that they're not behaving like a friend would behave, in that respect.
Right, but surely there are. To be sure, there are American agents in Britain today. There are British agents, as we've defined the term, in the United States. There are Canadian agents in the United States.
Well, yes, but there's the ones who are registering and are doing it out in the open. These are the ones who are being prosecuted for, the ones who are acting as agents, but are doing so without the full disclosure of their finances and other kinds of things that go along with registration.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it seems to me espionage is probably a greater threat, and even then I'm a little bit skeptical about its long-term consequences. It seems to me that if we think about U.S.-Russian relations, which are in a very interesting moment,
yes,
to put it mildly, that the danger or the influence of collusion, to use that word, by the Russian security services is far more significant than the fact that Maria Butina managed to get her picture taken with the leadership of the NRA.
And asked a question of Trump during the campaign and all kinds of things.
Okay, but so what? Oh, so she asked Trump what relations with Russia would be like. Clearly, far more important was Trump's answer than
yes.
He wanted close
the
relations.
Fact that he called on her, I think, is interesting.
Right.
But,
yeah. Well, it's interesting, but Well, do you think we should be, as though we're representatives of the United States ourselves?
Should the United States be worried?
Do foreign agents, whether they be of the Maria Butina mold, which is to say foreign citizens who've come to the United States, pretended to be one thing, but are actually another, promoting propaganda, essentially, are they a danger? And so I would ask you, David, do you see characters like Maria Butina as a danger, and or what do you make of the kind of Carter Page types, which is to say U.S. citizens who act as agents on behalf of foreign governments trying to shape policy?
I think they're a huge potential threat, honestly. One can imagine, let's imagine a world without the Foreign Agents Registration Act, in which foreign governments could engage in propaganda in your country without disclosing, imagine sort of like Russia today, but instead a foreign power infiltrating ABC, CBS, Fox News, oh, maybe that's already happened, and putting on propaganda paid for by a foreign government, but not disclosing it's being paid for by a foreign government, then buying up and using other kind of media outlets to create false narratives and disinformation campaigns. That, in a democracy that relies heavily upon freedom of the press and free exchange of ideas, to have sort of active disinformation campaigns going on, I think that's very dangerous, and it could have really damaging repercussions for the health of the democracy if people can't, you know, read the newspaper or watch the news at night thinking they're getting a relatively honest accounting by well-intentioned journalists, and that policies being made by Americans who are acting in the American interest and not acting in the interest of foreign powers. You know, I think that's the end of your democracy.
I'm not sure.
I think democracy is very fragile. And
I agree with you about that, but I'm not. If it's so fragile that Maria Butina can bring it down, then she
struck me as like manifestly both with her the. She's manifestly both incompetent, but the fact that she was be as successful as she was, you know, like
she's in jail.
She's in jail, but the fact that she for the better part of a year and a half was able to hobnob in these circles, you know, and get, you know, talk with and influence important Republican leaders and NRA leaders, and you know. They should have, as soon as, if they're sort of, you know, NRA leaders in their mid-60s, you know, being approached by a young 20-something Russian saying they're very interested in talking with them, and there's all these kinds of other kinds of accusations that are, you know, part of her indictment about sexual relationships and other things. Like, red lights should have been going off in their head saying, like, this isn't right. Imagine somebody who was much more capable and savvy and, you know, sophisticated.
Sure, but even, yeah, there are lots of embarrassing photos have come out in the past week or so since her arrest of Ms. Butina and all kinds of Republican luminaries, whether it's Wayne LaPierre, the president, then president of the NRA, or others. But, you know what? Politicians pose for pictures with people all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know how damning it is. I don't think she took a picture with Paul Ryan, but if she did, you know, what would that tell us? I mean, I agree with you, this is a danger, but I'm not so sure it's a mortal threat to democracy.
I think...
Because the media landscape is much bigger than that.
Oh, to be sure. One can imagine a scenario in which if right now this is only happening, if we think, on a fairly limited basis. If it happens on a much more expansive basis, keeps me up at night, among other things.
Yeah.
All right. Fate of the American Republic. We'll see what happens.
Well, I think we have all kinds of reasons to be concerned. There's no doubt about that. But I'm not so sure foreign agents are as great a threat as...
Oh, I don't think it's even on the top 10 list of things that are threatening the Republic in terms of the health of the democracy and the whole set of institutions.
Okay, when the history of the Trump administration is written.
If they're still historians still have to write it, yes, okay.
Yes. Carter Page and Maria Butina, are they major figures or are they footnotes?
I'm hoping they're footnotes.
Okay.
We will see. When our grandchildren write that, we will find out.
Right. Well, if so, then we've just wasted our listeners.
No. I think it's sad, but I think that context is important.
I mean, we probably should talk about espionage sometime, which is another dimension to all this, and is quite significant, but I'm sure we'll get a chance.
To be sure. That'll come out next week. Right. Last drops. Frank, what'd you got?
There was a film that came to light in the last week. There's a documentary done by PBS in Major League Baseball. And a film was shown. It was a color film that filmed by a man named Bill Murphy, who lives outside of Boston today, or in the Boston area. And on September 28, 1960, Murphy attended the last home game that Ted Williams played, and the great Red Sox player, and on September 28, 1960, and filmed Williams' last at-bat. Well, he actually filmed all of his at-bats that day. It's a 4-minute film that was recently came to light. Murphy basically has had it for the past 58 years. And he showed it to family and friends, but a very small number of people had seen it. And as some listeners will know, Ted Williams famously hit a home run in his last at-bat, which is the kind of perfect way for him to end his career. And the only film we had had of that to this point was a black and white film from one particular angle, which again, many people will have seen. And you see Williams kind of rounding the bases, skipping around the bases. And Murphy's film provides a totally different view of this event. It's kind of iconic event in the history of baseball. And it was aired this week, as I said, on PBS. You can find it. There was a story in the New York Times about it. And you can look at the film. It's about 4 minutes long. There are a couple of things that are really striking about it. One is, there are several things. One is the total absence of advertisements at Fenway Park.
The park looked very different.
The park looks very, very different. Also, how few people were there. Now, in 1960, the Red Sox weren't very good. It was an end-of-season game. But Murphy was able to move around the stadium. And this is another thing that's striking about the film is he filmed all four of Williams' at-bats that day, but he got them from different angles. Huh. And he got him, he clearly was able to move around the stadium quite easily filming this. And he was an art student, so he actually is quite a good filmmaker. So the quality of the composition of the film is really, really good. So it's definitely worth having a look at it. And it's this, it gives us a new view of this iconic moment in the history of baseball, but it's also a snapshot of a particular time, which is kind of September 1960.
Yeah.
The Red Sox weren't the kind of money-making machine they became today. They are today, and they became in subsequent years. The stadium was largely empty, and this young man, I think he was 19 years old, had the run of the place with his 8mm camera, and the film is definitely worth taking a look at, even if you're not a baseball fan. If you are a baseball fan, you should see it, and of course, if you're a Red Sox fan, like yours truly, you want to see this. David is sitting patiently through this because he's a Yankee fan, but anyway, there we are. So, David, what's your... So, anyway, have a look at Bill Murphy's film of Ted Williams' last at-bat. You can find...
Arguably the greatest hitter ever to play the game.
Yes. That's a real... Well, as a non-Red Sox fan, would you agree with that statement? Is he the...
I think he's at least in the running.
Okay, fair enough. That's a big concession. No, sure, yeah. What's your last drop, David?
So, I want to endorse another kind of film, and that is microfilm. And especially an article that appeared in The Atlantic recently in defense of microfilm, written by Craig Saper. Microfilm is a much criticized kind of medium, especially in the sort of the modern digital age. Lots of people have sort of dismissed microfilm as being sort of an antiquated format. But I think, as the article points out, microfilm is an extraordinarily useful format that's been around for about 70 years. I've used microfilm a lot in my own research.
Me too.
Now, the machines, if listeners have used microfilm, sometimes the machines break, it's hard to find parts for them, it's not great for one's eyes necessarily. But as the article points out, this is actually a remarkably stable medium and actually will probably outlive most of the digital media that we've got today. The microfilm, especially the new microfilms that are coming out, may last 500 years. So microfilm will outlive all of us. So I want to recommend people check out the article in defense of microfilm. And if you've never used microfilm, student listeners, by all means, try using microfilm.
It was awesome. Always a bit of a rite of passage in graduate school. Once you had to kind of go to the sub-basement of the library and read microfilm.
I think I started reading microfilm in middle school. I just found it just amazing to go and you're in this darkened, usually you read microfilm in a darkened room and it's sort of like you're in a cave and you're scrolling through this stuff and it's, issues from the New York Times from the 19th century. I think I spent months in high school going through the New York Times from the 1881 and 1882.
Ladies and gentlemen, David Silkenath, the junior high school years. You're getting a real insight now.
No, microfilm, I think, is one of the things that made me really love being a historian because you actually can see the papers from the time and you can sort of contextualize things in ways that, it's not quite the same digitally.
No, yeah. I agree with you on that. In fact, this might be another discussion, but... I remember reading loads of microfilm and microfiche, searching for things when I was doing my dissertation. Now, digital media allows for searching and keyword searches, which is great and much more efficient. But there was an immersion of the kind you're talking about, that when you had to kind of scroll through newspapers or pamphlets, you immersed yourself in a kind of the culture of the time in a way that is really important.
And you find things that you didn't think you were looking for that were important. And you see not only what you're looking for, but also the story that's next to it. And
how That's right.
Ways in which those articles would actually have been read. Anyway.
Microfilm.
To microfilm. Cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.